is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. We're going to do brunch with Bernie today instead of tomorrow, and he's with us live from the Senate Recording Studios. Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. So there's a lot on the plate these days. What's on the top of your list right now?
Well, there is a lot on the plate, and clearly one of the issues that we are focusing on is this TPP, this Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, which I will strongly oppose in every way that I can, and which I believe is nothing more than a continuation of past disastrous trade policies, which have cost our country millions of jobs and pushed us into a race to the bottom where real wages in America have gone down. The truth is that American workers should not be forced to compete against people in Vietnam who have a minimum wage of 56 cents an hour, or people in Malaysia where there is a lot of forced labor, where foreign workers in Malaysia have their passports taken away, have no rights whatsoever, and are working, in some cases, under slave-like conditions. That should not be the kind of competition that American workers are forced to be involved with. So we're going to do everything that we can to defeat the TPP. In a few minutes, or within the hour, I will be voting to support Loretta Lynch for Attorney General of the United States. And I'm glad that the vote is taking place. We think we're going to win the vote, although it's not 100% certain. I think there are four or five Republicans, or maybe six, so who knows, who will vote for her. But they have certainly obstructed her nomination in an unprecedented way in terms of an Attorney General nominee. It has taken forever to get this vote on the floor, and I think it just speaks to the continuation of Republican obstructionism. Yesterday, Tom, I was with a number of workers at a rally who are continuing the fight to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. And what yesterday's rally focused on was the fact that the United States government obviously has contracts with huge numbers of private companies. And what the rally was about is to say that if the United States government signs a contract with an employer, with a company, that company should pay good wages and make it possible for workers to join unions. That preference should be given to those companies who are paying decent wages and decent working conditions. Now, the good news there is that a time of massive income and wealth inequality in our country, at a time when many of the new jobs being created are low wage and part time, what we have seen in the last several years is a real growth in consciousness about the need to raise the minimum wage. We have seen state after state, city after city raise the minimum wage. Here in Washington, we have met, of course, with absolute obstructionism from the Republicans on this issue. The request brought forth by the Democratic leadership, which I thought was pretty modest, was for a 10-10 an hour increase in the minimum wage. We had zero Republican support for that. On another issue, as the ranking member of the Budget Committee, we held a conference committee earlier in the week. I think it was Monday afternoon. What's going on now is the Republican House budget is going to be brought together in conference committee with the Republican Senate budget. What I can tell you is the Republican Senate budget was a disaster. The Republican House budget was even worse. And one of the problems that we have in talking about the budgets, these budgets, is they are so bad that people literally don't even believe you when you tell them what's in the budget. But the Republican Senate budget would throw 27 million people off of health insurance. Now, we are the only major country on earth that doesn't guarantee health care to all people as a right. Despite the gains of the Affordable Care Act, we still have 35 million people without any health insurance. And what the Republican budget does is ends, they would terminate the Affordable Care Act, and that means that 16 million Americans who have insurance through the ACA, those people would lose their insurance. They would cut Medicaid by $440 billion, which means another 11 million Americans would lose their health insurance. 16 plus 11 is 27 million Americans suddenly would be thrown off health insurance. I mean, you stop and you think, my God, what does that mean? What happens to 27 million people who can no longer afford to go to the doctor, who get bankrupt, when they become ill? Not a problem. Republicans just threw 27 million people off health insurance. At a time when working class families are finding it increasingly difficult to send their kids to college, and many young people, bright young people, are choosing not to go to college because they can't afford it, what the Republican budget did is over a 10-year period cut $90 billion in Pell Grant mandatory funding. Cut that, $90 billion over 10 years, making it increasingly difficult for working class people to send their kids to college. They made major cuts in Head Start and Title I funding. At a time in America where we have over 40 million people living in poverty and many people struggling to feed their families, to put food on the table, the Republican budget made devastating cuts in food stamps and other nutrition programs. And then, to almost make this proposition laughable, beyond being pathetic, is that they decided that when you have the top 1% today earning 99% of all new income, goes to the top 1%, what they decided to do is give a major tax break to the wealthiest 0.2% by repealing the estate tax completely, which over a 10-year period would be about a $269 billion tax break for the wealthiest 0.2%, making income inequality even worse. And then they raised taxes on low-income and working families by doing away with the additional benefits that we put in to the earned income tax credit and the child tax credit. So they raise taxes on low-income and working families, lower taxes on the billionaire class, add another billions more for military spending, and then cut back substantially on the needs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. And I think, you know, if there's somebody listening to this and they're hearing me talk, they say, well, you know, it's Bernie Sanders. This really can't be true. He's exaggerating. He's being partisan. I know it is hard to believe. I recognize that. What I'm telling you is factually true. That's what it is. Now, sadly, you know, this issue of the budget does not get a whole lot of media attention. The New York Times and the Washington Post didn't have front page stories that the Republicans just threw 27 million people off of health insurance. Now, what happens, and the argument is, well, this is just the budget. It's not real legislation. It's the framework for real legislation. And that's true. But I think that there should be a whole lot more discussion about this disastrous budget than we have seen. Tom, those are some of the things that are keeping me busy this week.
Yeah, that's truly astonishing. You know, if the Democrats had passed a budget that socialized health care or something, you know, to create a national health service like the Brits have, it would be screaming headlines.
You might think so.
Amazing. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie, our live Thursday. Today is Thursday, and Senator Sanders is with us today. We appreciate that. We'll be right back with your calls for Bernie right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. He also has a very active Facebook presence. And welcome back. Senator, ready to take some calls?
Let's do it.
Okay, Mary, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Portland, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Mary?
Hi. Hi, this is Mary.
Mm-hmm. You're on the air, Mary.
And I'm just listening here to the program and listening to the senator. And it's just absolutely fantastic that I actually get to speak with a senator. I can't get a hold of either of mine to even respond to me. But my question, Tom, is I want to know when, I would like to know, Senator, when you are going to announce to run. We need you. Listening to you now, we have to have somebody who's out there who's telling the truth like you. Nobody else is going to do that. That's my problem with all the candidates. They're either lies or we're hearing the same old stuff. No, we need somebody out there telling the truth like it is. I'd really
Well, Mary, thank you very much. It is no secret, you know, we have talked on this program and I've talked elsewhere about my interest in running for president of the United States. And what I have said repeatedly is I will make a decision shortly. And the impediments, Mary, are twofold. If you do something as big as running for president of the United States, and that is a very, very difficult undertaking. I am very proudly the United States Senator from a very small state. The state of Vermont has 620,000 people in it, and I know my state, and I know how to run for office in my state. But running for president of the United States on a platform, if you like, that takes on Wall Street, the multinational corporations, the pharmaceutical industry, the military-industrial complex, the Koch brothers, takes on every part of the billionaire class. If you're going to do that, you have to do it very, very, very well. And, you know, you have to know that you have a political infrastructure around the country of people who are really not just going to vote for you, but are going to really be prepared to stand up and fight and participate in almost an unprecedented grassroots movement. So believe me, I'm going to South Carolina tomorrow. We'll see what exists there. We've been to Iowa. We've been to New Hampshire. I've been around the country. We've had some great turnouts. But when you undertake, when you go forward for a presidential run, that is just a huge undertaking, and I've got to know that we have that kind of grassroots support. And second of all, sadly, at a time of Citizens United, when the Koch brothers themselves will probably be spending close to $1 billion on this election cycle, and other billionaires will be pouring huge sums of money, you know, I don't need billions of dollars to run, but we have to be sure that at least we have an amount of money that is credible run a winning campaign. So, Mary, thank you very much for your support. If we do it, we have to do it well, not just for my own ego, but for you and for all of the people in America who believe that we need fundamental change. Because if I go forward and I don't run a good campaign, it impacts all of us and what we believe. So I'm thinking about it hard. I would like to do it. But I've got to make sure that we have the capability of doing it well.
Hey, oh, 2 seconds. Perfect. Senator, you timed it perfectly. we'll be right back. Oh, and this at the, by the way, day after tomorrow, I guess, Senator, is when Rick Perry, Ted Cruz, and Mike Pence go to Las Vegas to bow down at Shelley Adelson's door. He's paying George W. Bush $250,000 to give a speech there. John Boehner, Mitt Romney will be there. It's amazing. It's just amazing. We'll be back with Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back. Senator Sanders with us for the hour here on this beautiful Thursday in Washington, D.C. And Kevin in Santa Fe, New Mexico, you are on the air with listening to KTRC. You are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders. I really appreciate what you do and highly respect your stances and listen to what you do. I would like to ask, who is representing the American workers at this so-called table of negotiations in the TPP? Because we hear endlessly about all of the corporate interests that have a seat at the table, but is there a union representative or anybody there advocating for the American worker?
The answer is, in some cases, there are. In some sections of the TPP, unions have had input and have been involved. But I think it is fair to say that the overwhelming level of participation and input has come from hundreds of major corporate interests. So unions have had some input. Corporate America has had a heck of a lot more.
Craig in Chicago. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Tom, your show is always a must listen, and definitely when the senator is on. Senator, I just had a quick question. You know, defense budget and spending has been such a sacred cow for such a long time, and the number is insane compared to, you know, other countries and that. Is there any chance of change of that in the future? Is that something that's pretty much going to be stable? You know, one other quick thing is I don't think I've ever seen a sitting president with less respect. Senators and congressmen, when they're talking about the president, many times we'll never say President Obama. It'll just be Obama, you know, and it's like you never heard that before. Again, it's great listening to you both. I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig.
Well, Craig, let me start with your second point. I think you're quite right. President Obama has, to say the least, gotten less respect than any president than I have ever heard of. I mean, it starts when you have, you know, millions of Americans whipped up into believing that he wasn't even born in the United States of America, that he's an illegitimate president. Others believing that he's somehow affiliated with terrorism, or that he is, you know, doesn't love the United States of America, whether he's not a Christian or whatever it may be. But the kind of attacks that have been leveled against him and the kind of disrespect that has been shown to him and his family is, to my mind, in fact, unprecedented. In terms of the budget, I think the budgets that we're seeing from the House and the Senate really reflect a Republican Party, which has become a right-wing extremist party, beholden to the billionaire class, and whose primary focus in life is to make the rich much richer. And to continue devastating attacks against working families, against trade unions, against women. And that's where we're at. And I have said on many occasions that my greatest fear for this country is at a time when we have so much income and wealth inequality, at a time when, as a result of Citizens United, the Koch brothers and other billionaires can literally buy the United States government. I was talking to somebody the other day, very knowledgeable. And what he was telling me is that most campaigns now, in most campaigns, it's not going to be the candidate who raises the most money for himself. It is going to be super PACs. So candidates are not even going to be running their own campaigns. Most of the ads you're going to see on television are not going to be authorized by candidate X or candidate Y. They're going to be authorized by a super PAC controlled by billionaires. Candidate will be second fiddle. And that's where we are evolving. And unless we overturn Citizens United, unless we immediately move to disclosure so that when people put ads on television, their faces have got to be there acknowledging who paid for the ad, and unless we move toward public funding of elections, clearly the foundations of American democracy will be undermined.
We have just 1 minute left before the break, Senator.
Well, you know, the budget, I think, is just an example of where we are as a nation. And the continued assault on the middle class, since 1985, we have seen trillions and trillions of dollars leave the pockets of the middle class in this country. Their percentage of the wealth has gone down, and that has drifted up to the top one-tenth of 1%. So that in the last 2 years, you saw the 14 wealthiest people seeing a $157 billion increase in their wealth, while most people are seeing stagnation, economic stagnation, or maybe a decline in their standard of living. So this is not the America that we want to see. And we need some profound political and economic changes to make sure that the average person has a fair shot and that all of the wealth doesn't accumulate into the hands of a few.
Yeah, as it certainly seems to be doing. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie on Thursday. We'll be right back with your calls for the senator in just a few minutes. Be sure to check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, the newsletter. It's a great news site as well, sanders.senate.gov. Plus, you can also check out his activities over at Facebook and on Twitter. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And check out sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where despair is not an option. Get active. It's our brunch at Bernie hour, a day early here on Thursday. Senator Sanders, kind enough to come on the program with us from the Senate Recording Studios here in Washington, D.C. And let's see here. Randy in Ottawa, Iowa. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good day, gentlemen. Senator Sanders, my question for you is kind of a situation that I don't think that's happened yet. Here in Iowa, Governor Branstad is trying to privatize Medicaid, Medicare, and I think just Medicaid. And my question is that when you look at these corporations that are going to be taking taxpayers, it's like switching taxes from paying your state taxes to paying a corporation taxes directly. And when you look at how much insurance has gone up, and then the marketplace right now, we have corporations that are inverting. Is it feasible or is it possible that potentially that a citizen, say, of Iowa could end up paying taxes directly to a corporation that is registered in a foreign country? Or is it legal for, like, Burger King to collect state taxes for the states because they are no longer an American company? So I'll try not to complicate it anymore.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, you've touched on, Randy, you've touched on a number of issues, and that is the goal of Republicans, whether it is a Republican governor in Iowa or the Republican Senate or the Republican House, to do everything that they can to privatize any governmental operation. It is no great secret to you, Randy, I'm sure, that our Republican friends under Bush wanted to move to the privatization of Social Security. Republicans every day are working to privatize Medicare. They want to make massive cuts in Medicaid. There are many Republicans now who want to privatize all or some of the Veterans Administration healthcare system. There are Republicans who certainly would like to destroy the United States Postal Service, and they are moving rapidly in that direction and privatizing that. You have a group like the Koch brothers who basically believe that the United States government should not be involved in almost any activity, or state government, whether education or anything else. All of this should be done by the private sector, Wall Street for retirement security, et cetera, et cetera. So, Randy, I am not all that aware of what's going on in terms of Medicaid in Iowa, but what you're telling me certainly is not surprising to me.
Matt in East Jordan, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator, given the scope of the TPP, don't you think the potential Democratic supporters of the probable Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton deserve a straight answer from just an unambiguous answer about whether she supports the TPP or whether she's against it? And frankly, shouldn't all the presidential hopefuls, given that, you know, the scope of the TPP, let the American people know whether they're really for this or against it? You know, give us the honest truth.
Well, Matt, I absolutely agree with you. And I issued a statement just the other day saying almost word for word what you're saying. And look, people can have honest disagreements about the TPP. Trade has been very controversial. As I mentioned a moment ago, Tom, I happen to believe that NAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China and other trade agreements have been an absolute disaster for the American worker. It is one of the reasons why we have seen the loss of some 60,000 factories since 2001, millions of decent-paying jobs gone. I was just looking at some numbers now with regard to Vietnam. The minimum wage in Vietnam is 56 cents an hour. Nike employs over 300,000 people, mostly women, young women, in Vietnam producing athletic shoes. They do not employ one person in America producing athletic shoes in manufacturing. You know, I don't think that the American worker's got to compete against people in Vietnam who are working under those kind of wages, terrible working conditions, can't form a union. Malaysia may be even worse in some cases, where you literally have slave labor, where immigrant people into Malaysia have been had their passports taken away. They have no rights. They can't leave the country. I don't think that that is what the American worker has to be competing against. That's my view. But what Matt asked is this an issue that that Hillary Clinton and every other presidential candidate should be speaking out on? And the answer is yes. You got it. This is not you can't wiggle your way out of this one. Either you're going to vote and support the TPP. President Obama, sadly enough, does support it. He's pushing it hard. Most Democrats in the Congress are against it. Some are for it. Virtually all Republicans are for it. Some are against it. So you can't wiggle your way out of it. You can't say, well, I'm observing it. I'm monitoring it. There's going to be a vote. And if you were in the Senate, would you vote for it? Would you vote against it? So I agree with Matt. I think not just for Hillary Clinton, but this is an enormously important issue that every presidential candidate should be very clear and unambiguous about.
John in Chicago, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you. I have a question for the senator on the topic of TPP. To protect the U.S. from the TPP ever being approved, will you filibuster the bill that would grant the president fast-track approval rights?
Well, John, unfortunately, if that were the case, I certainly would. But what a filibuster does is slows it down. It doesn't prevent something from
being
passed.
You did that yesterday, didn't you?
I did that yesterday, yes. Yes, so, John, what we did yesterday is we did slow it down. And some of my colleagues were not all that happy that they had to stay up very late in the night working on the legislation. So we did slow it down, and I will continue to do everything I can to oppose it. But I don't want you to think for a moment that a filibuster will prevent it from getting a vote. What we are trying to do now is rally the American people. I was at a rally right here in Washington, D.C. It was a great rally organized by the AFL-CIO and a number of other groups. We had a huge turnout. And I think, you know, all over this country. And by the way, Tom, this is not just Democrats. If you want the truth, I think that there are more Republicans for a variety of reasons who are opposed to unfettered free trade than Democrats.
Yeah.
And I think to the degree that the American people understand this trade issue, which gets so little coverage on network television, the American people know that when you go to a store today, it is harder and harder to buy a product made in the United States of America. More often than not, the product is made in China, Vietnam, or elsewhere. The American people know there was once a time when if you didn't have a college degree, you could work in a factory. And if you had a union, you could make a living wage. You could have a good benefit. You may have a pension. That is no longer the case because so many of those jobs are gone, and the jobs that are open are McDonald's or Walmart, low wages, minimal benefits. The American people see that transition in the American economy. And trade has been one of the reasons, not the only one. Automation, robotics has been another part. But there's no question in my mind that corporate America has taken advantage of these trade agreements to shut down plants in America, to outsource our jobs to low-wage countries, and they want to continue to expand doing that. So I am against these trade agreements. I think that presidential candidates should be very clear about which side they're on.
Okay. And Jim in Lockport, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Tom. Good afternoon, Senator Sanders.
Jim.
Senator Sanders, the situation down in the Gulf after 5 years hasn't improved much, really. And the people down there are struggling. They've lost about 70% of their income. Is there anything that the Senate could do to hold BP's feet to the fire, so to speak? Now, they did agree to a $20 billion settlement, but they're tying it up in courts, waiting for people to die off. This is unfair to these folks. Is there anything we can do about that?
Is it the same thing they did 25 years ago?
Yes, we can, Jim. And I would hope very much that the Obama administration will be much more aggressive in terms of making sure that people get the benefits and the compensation that they are owed for that terrible, terrible disaster caused by BP.
Charles in Mandeville, Indiana. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, good morning, Senator Sanders. I'm in Louisiana, but that's okay.
Sorry.
Senator Sanders, I just want to start by saying thank you for having the courage and the intestinal fortitude to stand up for the middle class and say what's right. I know it's really hard, difficult thing that you do, and I really appreciate it. And my question is, despite all of the things that you've been discussing and constantly we go over these things, why do you think voter turnout and complacency among the electorate is so low?
Charles, great question. And I'll give you my best answer. Other people may have different opinions. I think that what happens is the average American looks out at around what's going on in his life or her life. And what they see is that they're working longer hours for low wages. They're terribly worried about whether their kids are going to be able to get a decent education, the quality of their health care, whether they can afford health care. They look at the growing gap between the billionaire class and everybody else. And they ask themselves, who's listening to me? Who understands the pain that I am experiencing? And they look to Washington and they said, not many folks there. Why do I want to give credibility to a system that is so corrupt? And they don't vote. We've got to change that, because if they don't vote, it only becomes worse. But that's my feeling about it, Charles.
We'll be back with more of your questions for Senator Bernie Sanders right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Brunch with Bernie on Thursday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Check out his website, Sanders.Senate.gov. And welcome back.
Tom, if we could, let me get back to Charles. We have to rush the answer to Charles because he's asked a very important question. I'd like people to weigh in on it. There is massive demoralization politically in this country. In the last election, 80% of young people didn't vote. And, you know, I reiterate that I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that people are struggling and they don't hear members of the Congress speaking out on their behalf, indicating that they understand what's going on, that they understand what it means not to have any health insurance or not to be able to pay your deductibles, to understand what it means that when you're 50, you lose your job and somebody replaces you making half the wages, understanding that you may be working two or three jobs just to make an income, understanding that if your car breaks down and you lose your job, you're in financial disaster. This is the lives of millions of Americans. And I think they look to Washington and they don't see discussion about that. And they say, why would I want to vote? It doesn't matter who wins. The rich are going to get richer and I'm going to get poorer. Who cares? And I think, Charles, that unless we educate and organize and raise public consciousness and point the finger at those members of Congress or governors who are prepared to defend the billionaire class and ignore the needs of working families, that unless we can educate and organize, the situation only becomes worse. Because when the billionaires can spend so much money on elections, the only hope we have is in large voter turnouts where people say enough is enough. And if people do not come out and vote, then we lose, period.
Merlene in Morriston, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Senator Sanders, I'm calling regarding the TPP. I think the American people are entitled to an open and transparent debate. The president threw down the gauntlet and said he would be willing to debate, and I think we need to take him up on it. And the excellent debater would be Senator Elizabeth Warren. But we need to get that out there, and we need to accept his challenge. And that's why I'm calling.
Thank you, Marlene.
Well, Marlene, thank you very much. Elizabeth Warren would be very good, and there are a number of other people. Sherrod Brown from Ohio is helping to lead the effort. I've been involved. Bob Casey has been involved. We got a number of good people, both in the House and the Senate, who I think are engaged in this debate. The problem that the president has is that he is defending a trade agreement which has the strong support of virtually every corporation in America. The pharmaceutical industry, by the way, I didn't speak much about this one, Tom, but one of the provisions in there, which is very frightening and which concerns groups like Doctors Without Borders, who do a great job taking care of providing medical care to some of the poorest people in the world, who are very much opposed to this agreement,
because they understand that if this agreement goes forward, the pharmaceutical industry will be able to extend the length of time on its intellectual property, on its patents, making it harder for poor countries to switch over to generics and provide lower-cost drugs to their people who need it. And this could cost the lives of a whole lot of people who simply cannot afford life-saving drugs that are brand name. So that's another issue that is out there of great concern.
To me, it's like a show of horrors. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on Thursday on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back with more of your calls for the Senate. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour on Thursday. Senator Sanders answering your questions. Terry in Portland, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, thank you, Tom. And Senator, it's a pleasure to speak with you. As odious as this TPP sounds to me, what I find even more disturbing is this fast tracking of the negotiations. And Ron Wyden, being one of our senators out here, seems to have been hunkering down and not willing to answer a lot of questions about his willingness to be the handmaiden for this negotiation. Curious if you had a chance to visit with Senator Wyden and find out what his motivations are, because frankly, out here in Oregon, we're not a big fan of this, and as a matter of fact, he's getting a lot of heat locally. Have you had a chance to visit with him on this, Senator?
Well, I see, you know, almost all senators every day, so, you know, Ron and I have talked. And let me just simply say that Ron and I have a very strong disagreement on the TPP. Ron has worked hard to try to make it as good a bill as he thinks he can make it, dealing with some very conservative Republicans. But I am very strongly opposed to this. Ron is supportive of it, and we disagree strongly.
Sue in Green Bay, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, gentlemen. I have a statement and then a question for you. I saw Elizabeth Warren last night on MSNBC, and she asked everyone who's in opposition to go to her site, ElizabethWarren.com, and sign a petition. I'd like to beg everybody to do that today, now. Also, I'd like to know, Senator, what can we do right now to make our opposition to TPP known?
Well, I would, Sue, get on the phone right now and get on your computer and start emailing. And let's get a flood of phone calls. I know, unless I'm very mistaken, at least one of your senators in Wisconsin is going to vote for this agreement. Let them hear from you. And get the word out to friends all over this country. Sign the petitions. Let the members of Congress know that the American people know what's going on and that they're not going to forget this vote, that we don't want to continue these disastrous trade agreements. So, Sue, get the computer out, get your phone out, call up Capitol Hill, and let's get the word to the United States Senate and to the House of Representatives.
And the number for Congress's switchboard is 202-225-3121, and that gets you to the operator. You could tell her what state or him, whoever answers. Tell them what state you're from, and they will tell you who your senators are, and they will connect you directly with their offices. Keith in Shorewood, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, gentlemen. You both do great work. Appreciate what you do. It's a pleasure to be on. Senator, you mentioned before what ideas would we have about getting people out to vote. I think for starters, the opposition party has to provide a vision. The Democrats, as we saw in the last election, were very timid about coming out and defending things such as the ACA and the fact that we've been able to move out of the recession. You know, that also couples along with the fact that there's a lot of things that progressives can point to in terms of what we've done for society. And unless we tell people that our brand is better than their brand, people aren't going to want to buy what we're selling.
Keith, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that is clearly one of the reasons why the Democrats did so poorly in the last election. And I think you're also right in saying that we need an agenda. And I think the agenda, and I've been working on that and have some proposals that are out there. Other people may have some different ideas, but I think the ideas that we can bring forth are exactly the ideas that most Americans, not all, to be sure, support. For example, Keith, if I were to tell you that this country needs to create millions of jobs because real unemployment is not 5.5%, but 11%, if you include those people who have given up looking for work and those people who are working part-time, and then we need to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure, our roads, bridges, rail system, you know what? Most people in America would say, that's right. Let's create millions of jobs rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. If I were to say to you, let's raise the minimum wage to a living wage, do you know what most Americans would say? Yeah, that's a pretty good idea. If I were to say to you that let's establish pay equity so women don't earn 78 cents on the dollar, you would say, yeah, that's fair, that's right. If I were to say to you, let's transform our energy system away from fossil fuels so we can lead the world in combating climate change and move to energy efficiency and sustainable energy and create a whole lot of jobs doing that, I think most Americans would say, that's a pretty good idea. If we were to say, you know what, Wall Street has just too much power. They're too big to fail. Maybe they're too big to exist. Let's break them up. I think the American people would say, yeah, that's a pretty good idea. If I were to say to you, let's make college affordable so that young people can go to school without coming out, graduating deeply in debt, most Americans would say that's a pretty good idea. Most Americans think that we should not give huge tax breaks to billionaires and large corporations, but that they should start paying their fair share of taxes. All of those ideas, every single one of them, has majority support in America. And that's the kind of campaign that we have to wage. We have to be clear. Nothing changes in America unless we're prepared to take on the big money interests and the big billionaire class. So, Keith, you're right. We need a progressive agenda. It's an agenda that I think would resonate with the vast majority of the people in this country. And that's what we should be doing.
Senator, we have a minute left. Your thoughts for the week?
Well, my thoughts for the week is that we are obviously going to be focusing today. As soon as I leave you, Tom, I'm heading to the floor, and I'll be on the floor in a few minutes speaking about the TPP, trying to generate more opposition to an agreement that I think does not have the support of working people in this country. But it gets back to Keith's good question. We need a progressive agenda that speaks to the needs of ordinary Americans, that is prepared to take on the billionaire class, that is prepared to move in a different direction than where this country is currently moving. So,
step by step. Senator Sanders, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
It's always great to talk to you. We will be back. Sheriff Richard Mack, actually, is going to drop by, and then we're going to do Anything Goes Thursdays. So stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us, very pleased to welcome back Sheriff Richard Mack, founder of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, Board of Directors of the Oath Keepers Movement, oathkeepers.org, former
Graham County, Arizona Sheriff, CSPOA.org is the website, and SheriffMack.com as well. Sheriff, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Tom. It's always good to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. I got a note from you that you wanted to ask me why I'm in the bag for the Democratic Party. Do I have that right?
You sure do, yes. Because, Tom, you and I have said this on your show before, that we have a mutual respect for each other, even though we disagree on a lot of issues. To me, I find it bewildering that somebody as educated and researched and historically sound as you are could still be an apologist and supporter for Democratic policies that are so obviously unconstitutional. Now, I call out both Democrats and Republicans. I don't care. Whichever one is degrading the Constitution, is degrading freedom and liberty, and is promoting policies that are clearly outside constitutional parameters, I call them both out. For instance, John McCain, he's nothing but a lying dirtbag politician, career politician, and the same with Harry Reid. Harry Reid is nothing but a liar, scumbag politician who cares only about his own power and position, just like John McCain. There's very few. In fact, I have said this on your show, and I'll say it again. There is no hope in Washington, D.C. to restore personal liberty in America. If we're going to do it, it's going to have to happen in the communities and counties and cities, and it's going to have to be from the bottom up. And we've got to make the bureaucrats and criminals in Washington, D.C., especially the IRS and EPA and others, we've got to make those criminals irrelevant, and we can, county by county and sheriff by sheriff and state by state. And the 10th Amendment, of course, as you know, is my calling card. And I find it very startling and amazing that we revere someone like Bill Clinton, who has had sex parties in the Oval Office, and he doesn't leave in disgrace. He's honored and revered as the number one Democrat in the world. He's paid all this money to go speak, and he's on television and everything, yet Richard Nixon lies about a cover-up regarding a burglary at Watergate Hotel, and he leaves in disgrace. Both of them are disgraceful. Both of them are pathetic. In fact, my favorite quote, my joke about Bill Clinton is, because I sued the federal government when he was president, I'm the only person in history to sue Bill Clinton on a non-sexual matter. You know, and I think it's a great joke, but it's also very truthful in a lot of respects. And I think he disgraced the office, and yet he is revered by Democrats, and it doesn't matter. And he's revered by a lot of people throughout the world.
Well, in some ways, Sheriff, Bill
and
Clinton.
I just say both sides. It has to be both sides.
No, I understand your perspective, and I with regard to Bill Clinton, I think he's going to turn out to be one of his wife's biggest liabilities if she becomes the nominee. But
I personally think she is, but that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. But you asked why I'm in the bag for the Democratic Party, and you mentioned that. You know, your concern about things like the EPA being unconstitutional, Social Security being unconstitutional, et cetera, Obamacare,
right.
And that you want to have personal freedom. You're
correct.
Fond of freedom. Okay.
Correct.
Here's where we start out in very different places. My understanding of the Constitution is informed by reading Alexander Hamilton, who, you know, was a major contributor to it. And Hamilton, you can read this in his report on manufactures. He was Secretary of the Treasury in 1791, and he wrote this report to Congress. It was the official position of the George Washington administration. And in it, he goes at some length to point out that both in the preamble to the Constitution and in the beginning and the end of Article 1, Section 8, they say that Congress can do anything that will improve the public welfare. Right. This is here's.
Well, that's a paraphrase, and it's not exactly.
Well, okay. Let me give you the exact quote then. Here's the exact quote.
A question has laws to.
No, hang on just a second. This is the basis of mine. Okay. He says this is Alexander Hamilton. He says a question has been made concerning the constitutional right of the government of the United States to apply this species of encouragement. What he was talking about then was actually subsidies to industries in the United States that we considered vital industries. Yeah. He said, but there is certainly no good foundation for such a question. The national legislature has express authority to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare, with no other qualifications than that all duties, imposts, excises shall be uniform throughout the United States and that no tax shall be laid on articles exported from any states. These three qualifications accepted, the power to raise money is plenary and indefinite, and the objects to which it may be appropriated are no less comprehensive than the payment of the public debts and the providing for the common defense and general welfare. The terms general welfare were doubtless intended to signify more than was expressed or imported in those which preceded, in other words, the other items in Article 8, or, Section 1, Article 8. The phrase is as comprehensive as any that could have been used because it was not fit that the constitutional authority of this union to appropriate its revenues should be restricted within narrower limits than the general welfare, and because this necessarily embraces a vast variety of particulars which are susceptible neither to specification nor definition. Alexander Hamilton, 1791. George Washington agreed with him. Thomas Jefferson agreed with him.
No.
John Adams agreed with him. Everybody agreed with him. There was no dissent to that, Sheriff.
Well, yeah, I could quote you a lot from Jefferson and Washington and Madison, who did disagree with him. He was about the only one who supported a big central government, and it was rejected.
No, we have that. We have Hamilton's America.
Grave. Hamilton also would be turning over in his grave as to how far we have allowed our socialistic government to go in this country. And if you go through the list of the reasons why in the Declaration of Independence that they petitioned for redress and that they actually used as excuses for going to war, we're doing over half of them today.
Yeah.
And to ignore the historical
excuses going to war. I'm with you on that.
The Revolutionary War, and that we do it worse now, and to say, well, why did the Founding Fathers risk their lives and fortunes and sacred honor to fight for freedom and liberty, and then now we just legislate it away, and that we all the worst things going on in our country.
That's the other definition.
All the worst things in our country are both the Democrats and Republicans.
Okay. I think that we have a different reading of the Constitution,
one that
first of all.
I can get you on right now.
And secondly, I think we have a different definition of freedom.
We do.
I believe, as a matter of fact.
It stays out of my life.
Well, I know. I mean, just look at the history of economies. I wrote a book about this called Screwed. The natural state of a capitalistic economy with very little regulation is the way that Europe ran for 1,000 years. It's called feudalism. You have very few, very rich people. You have a very small middle class, and they're basically the people who cater to the middle class.
And that has increased in America since Barack Obama has been in office and George Bush.
And a very large class of the working poor.
You're the Democrats who caused that very problem you're talking about.
And therefore, I believe that if you don't regulate capitalism and you don't have a certain relatively, absolutely answerable to the people amount of socialism.
You know, it always has been regulated, like, the monopoly problems, which have been enforced. But for you to justify, and any Democrat to justify, the regulations that have taken over the Second Amendment and the First Amendment and destroy liberty at will, and property ownership by the EPA is completely destroyed.
See,
and the EPA and the IRS issue fines to America, to Americans, without due process, which is required by the law, which is required by the Supreme Court.
I'm a big fan. I'm with you on due process. I mean, there's many areas where we agree, but. Well, I think I've said my piece. I'm guessing you have, too, and I have no need to have the last word here. Sheriff Richard Mack, founder of the Constitutional Sheriffs and Peace Officers Association, CSPOA.org. Thank you, Sheriff.
Let's do it again, Tom.
Indeed. We should keep this conversation going. I find it fascinating. Thank you for dropping by. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anything goes Thursday right after this. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. Susan, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Susan, what's up?
Hi.
Hi.
So great to talk to you again, Tom. I just moved to Tampa, Florida, so
uh-huh.
In the warm country.
Yeah.
It's a very, very interesting state down here. It's unbelievable that I just followed that call because I've been thinking about coming on since the last time you had a libertarian person on because I was a libertarian, started out the Republican Party, Young Republicans, and for years became more involved and dragged more and more and more to the right until right after the crash when I started to say, well, there's something going on wrong here, what it is, and started to find out what was going on. But I believe that I can tell you what the Achilles heel of libertarianism is.
Okay.
And if we start out by looking at it as cult, which you mentioned yesterday, I said, now we've got to call it time. It absolutely is. That's what I've always said, because it's extreme, black and white, right and wrong.
Well, and it's based on a belief system that has never successfully been tried anywhere on Earth.
Yes. Right. It's fanatic because there is a divergence between reality, and you even see the reality, but you can't bring yourself to believe your own lying eyes, you know. Mm-hmm. They have meetings, literature, ideology, the whole thing. But when it runs, it's very, very hard to convince people, because it's not like discussing politics. It is more like a religious undertaking. But what the Achilles heel is everybody has to die, and somebody's going to have to clean up after you, whether it's just your body or whatever it is that you leave behind. You may leave behind riches so that there's a lot of money to put you in a golden tomb or whatever. But for most of the people of the world, and that's who they're trying to do, they're trying to convince the masses to become libertarians.
What is the Achilles heel you were talking about, Susan, you said you'd found?
When you die, somebody has to clean up after you. And how does libertarian philosophy handle that? You can't get anybody else to spend money on you. So unless the government enforces some sort of
I think libertarians acknowledge family. I mean, the assumption that your family is going to bury you when you die.
What if they decide they don't want to, or you don't have family? I don't have any family who could bury me, for instance. So I better make sure that I don't impose on the state to take care of my remains and take down my house or whatever. But the fact that everybody dies, we leave behind things that have to be taken care of. And if you are an extreme libertarianism and an individualist, ultimately, it's like the debater on the roundtable said, if I fall over, don't send an ambulance after me, just leave me die in the street. And that's when it suddenly struck me, who's going to pay the money to clean your body up off the street even?
Right.
So libertarianism, in its final analysis, cannot work because you cannot ultimately never depend on impinging on other people's life.
In other words, there's always a time when we have to depend on society, even if that time happens the day after we're dead. There will always be a time when we have to depend on society.
And cost them money. Exactly.
Right. Brilliant, Susan. Thank you. Thank you for calling, and thank you for sharing, and thank you for watching Free Speech TV. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Thursday here on the Tom Hartman program. I got a number of things I want to rant about, but this, you know, I would like to just answer Sheriff Mack's question for you. You know, I tried to answer it for him, and I don't think he's not here, so we'll take him out of the equation. I believe that the Constitution is not a sacred document. I believe that there's a lot of really smart stuff in the Constitution. Some really brilliant people put it together. But there was some really evil stuff in the Constitution at the beginning of this country, slavery specifically. There was no specific right to vote because of slavery. Guns were protected to protect the slave patrols in the South because of slavery. The sins of slavery infiltrated the Constitution at the birth of our country. And it took 70, 80 years to get slavery out of the Constitution, but we still don't have the right to vote in it. And so Republicans are continuing to try to prevent people who, you know, won't fall in line with the billionaire agenda from voting. So, number one, I respect the Constitution. I think that we should live by the Constitution. I think we should make our laws based on the Constitution. But that said, my reading of the Constitution is very different from Sheriff Max in that I don't believe, you know, he and many of the folks of that worldview are going with this, the enumerated powers thing, you know, and basically Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which lists the powers of Congress, at least in theory. Well, no, in practice. It's called powers granted to Congress. Section 8, the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, blah, 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 blah. And, well, here, I'll just read it straight. The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. That's how it opens. And as Alexander Hamilton pointed out, general welfare can mean whatever Congress decides it means. He said, you know, we wanted to have a term. Well, here's what he said. He said the terms general welfare were doubtless intended to signify more than was expressed or imported in those which preceded. Otherwise, numerous, in other words, the, you know, well, here's the other things, Article 1, Section 8, you know, number 1, to borrow money, number 2, to regulate commerce, number 3, to establish naturalization, number that's 4 or 5, to coin money, 6, punishment of counterfeiting, 7, to establish post offices and roads, 8, patents, 9, to constitute tribunals inferior to the Supreme Court, in other words, create federal courts, 10, to punish felonies and piracies committed on the high seas, 11, to make war. These are the powers granted to Congress, Article 1, Section 8. Number 12, to raise and support armies. Number 13, to provide and maintain a navy. 14, to rule, to make rules for the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. 15, to provide for calling forth the militia. 16, to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. 17, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, in other words, basically has control over Washington, D.C., okay? And then number 18, to make all, this is the last of the enumerated powers, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. So number one, I don't consider most of these things far right conservatives consider unconstitutional. I don't consider them unconstitutional. I think that they're absolutely consistent with the Constitution. Number one. And number two, I have a different definition of freedom than people on the right do. I agree with Franklin Roosevelt that if you don't have a job, you're not free. If you don't have a means of supporting yourself and there is no means available to support yourself, you're not free. I agree with Franklin Roosevelt that if you get sick and you don't have access to health care, you're not free. I agree with Franklin Roosevelt that if you are hungry and unable to feed yourself and your family, you're not free. Roosevelt quoted in 1930s July 27, 1936, Philadelphia, I think it was, when Franklin Roosevelt accepted his nomination for his second term. He said, an old English judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. I agree with that. And I know that capitalism without regulation will result in the vast majority of the population being basically poor workers, serfs, wage slaves, in almost a literal sense. They pretty much have to do whatever it takes to get that job and to satisfy that employer and all that kind of thing, if they can find a job. And I think that regulating capitalism and providing a democratic socialist backstop, and yes, I'll use that word, socialist, the way that they do in Europe, in Northern Europe, we know now from over 100 years of experience, it actually works. Libertarianism has never, ever been tried successfully anywhere.
Tom's book, Screwed, tells how the cons have stuck it to the middle class. Somebody today will get a free copy when they call into the show.
We'll be back with your calls. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. And let's see here. Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for your show and the format you lay out. It's very informative.
Thank you.
Yeah. I've got a question about the estate tax. Actually, it's a two-part question.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that the Congress and Senate have passed the repeal of it. I'm just wondering if this is still subject to veto by the President Obama.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. And then the second part, you know, I saw a congressman, Republican from, I forget which state now, he's on C-SPAN, and he was kind of defending the repeal, talking about the small businesses that would be affected, like farms. And
right.
My question is if these people are going to give this stuff to their heirs, why couldn't they just transfer it before their deaths?
They can. One of the things that you didn't hear that Republican congressman talk about when he was saying that we need to do away with the so-called death tax, the estate tax, one of the things you didn't hear him talk about was the name of any business or farm that was lost as a consequence of this tax. Right. In the last decade, in the last two decades, probably in my lifetime, if any company had gone down the tubes, a substantial family farm or a company, what instead he would be saying, rather than speaking in the abstract, he'd be saying, well, this is like last year when the Johnson family ranch was lost because they couldn't pay the taxes. This would be like, 6 months ago when the Stop and Shop in Sacramento, California went out of business because the owner died and they couldn't pay the estate tax. This would be like, he would give you examples. There would be actual examples. There are no examples. Or if there are, they are so old and so obscure that they're meaningless.
Now, isn't this just a progressive tax also?
It is, yeah.
And then, so the lower end wouldn't get hurt that much. And
it's a progressive tax that caps at 17%. And you don't even pay the first penny until after you've transferred over $5 million. The bottom line here, Dave, is this is not a tax on people who are dying. This is a tax on the transfer of money. This is what's the difference? There's the egg and sperm lottery of life, right? The lucky sperm club as they used to refer to it. Are the folks who got rich because they were born of a rich family, right? The Koch brothers' daddy made a fortune with Joe Stalin and turned, with building Koch Industries and the oil company and turned it over to his sons. So they're recipients. They're members of the lucky sperm club. How is being born to a person who is rich, which is just luck, any different from winning the lottery? And when somebody wins the lottery, don't we tax that as income?
Yeah.
How is it different?
Well, it isn't. And it seems to me it's just a big giveaway to the super rich is what it's all about.
Yeah, well, it's a big giveaway to the children of the super rich that perpetuates this whole landed gentry thing that we've got going here in the United States, where you've got dynastic families that now, the Koch brothers and a few other families are basically setting themselves up to run American politics. It is mind-boggling. So, anyhow, Dave, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, I want to ask Bernie about the Federal Reserve, given what's happening in Greece. It's important because Greece is pretty much putting all their funds into their central bank, and they're getting ready to go on their own.
And I don't think so.
Bernie said something else I like to connect the dot. He was saying, what is needed to get the people out to vote?
Right.
And we see what happened in Greece when the people got turned off with their political parties.
Yeah.
They voted no austerity.
Yeah, and they voted in Syriza. And Syriza is trying to take a middle ground. They're trying to keep them in the EU, and I'm guessing that they probably will. It's very interesting to watch what's going on in Greece. But it's a clear example that this Republican austerity that we see in the sequester, we see in all these other efforts of the Republicans to cut back on programs that help working class people, is a disaster for an economy. It's just that simple. It's an absolute disaster. With regard to the Fed, Bernie is probably one of the best guys on that. He and Dennis Kucinich, he in the Senate, Dennis Kucinich in the House, got attached to the stimulus bill, I believe, the one of the bailouts, whatever it was, very early legislation in 2009, when President Obama had just become president, that mandated an audit of the Fed for the year 2008. And when they audited the Fed, they discovered that the Fed had been passing out trillions of tens of trillions of dollars to individual billionaires, to yep. foreign banks, to for-profit corporations like GE. I mean, it's yeah. just, I mean, they just been passing out money like there was no tomorrow. And
can you imagine if that money was going to us?
I know. This is, you know, this is, and thank you, Jesse, for the call. This is, you know, again, in answer to Sheriff Mack's question, why am I in the bag for the Democrats? This is what FDR did. When he came into office in 1933, in March of 1933, every bank in America had closed. And all across America, there were people who had mortgages. And the average mortgage in the United States, the standard for mortgages in the United States was 5 years with a balloon at the end, because mortgages were relatively new things. Used to be you saved up your money and bought your property, and the parents' house got larger and larger as the family grew and all that kind of thing. But the banks had started loaning money, and they had these five-year balloon loans. And property values have been going up so rapidly during the 1920s because Warren Harding in 1921, when he became president, Republican Harding, did basically exactly the same thing Reagan did, cut taxes on the rich. He cut them from 91% down to 25%, and the top tax rate on the rich, and deregulated industry, and started privatizing government functions, and it created this bubble that stimulated the housing market. And so you had people who were buying houses with no intention of keeping them more than 5 years. And so what FDR did was he said, okay, we've got millions and millions of people in this country who have mortgages that there's no way they will be able to pay them when they come due within those 5 years. So we're going to buy those mortgages from the banks and let those people let us be the bank. Let us be the creditor. And it was called the Mortgage Resolution. No, it wasn't Resolution Trust. That was something that happened during the Reagan era. Anyhow, there was a name for this program. And what we did was we had our government give 30-year mortgages to people who had 5-year mortgages to begin with. When you take a 5-year mortgage, you're paying $100 a month on. You may turn it into a 30-year mortgage. It becomes $30 a month. Now people can afford it. They can keep their house. The interest rates were really, really low. My dad, when he was alive, I remember he used to joke about how he bought the house that I pretty much grew up in. We moved into it when I was 5 or 6 years old in Lansing. He bought that for either $13,000 or $15,000. I mix them up in my brain, but one or the other. It was a relatively inexpensive house in South Lansing. And he had a loan on it because he was a GI out of World War II. He had a government-backed loan at 3%. And he used to laugh constantly. The banks were saying, hey, you know, wouldn't you love to take some equity out of your home? In other words, roll that mortgage over and flip it into a 6% loan or a 7% loan or an 8%. That's what FDR did. And that's what we should be doing right now. I mean, we already know how to do this stuff. This is what makes me so crazy. And, of course, you know, the billionaires don't want any of it done. They don't want, you know, the breaks going to average working people. They only want the breaks going to the billionaires. I mean, I understand that. But that doesn't make it right. By the way, there's a couple of other things I wanted to share with you today. I realize I've got a bunch of calls, and I'll get back to you in just a second. 10 years ago in Baltimore, this was 10 years before Freddie Gray, there was another fellow who was... This was in 2005, another Baltimore man. I'm reading this over at the Daily Beast. Don D. Johnson, 42 years old. He was arrested for public urination, and he was loaded into that police van, very similar to the one that was used to transport Gray. And it says, Mr. Johnson got in the back of the van without assistance. He obeyed the officer's commands and did not threaten any of the officers or act violently. So he was in fine shape. They put him in the van, and then they gave him what was called the Baltimore Rough Ride. You're in the back of a van, which is all metal, no seatbelt, and the car just starts lurching around, flying around corners. In fact, the driver testified that she made it to the police station in half the time it would have taken had she only gone the speed limit. And when Mr. Johnson got out of the van, his neck was broken. What a surprise. You throw someone around in the back of a metal box attached to the back of a vehicle, which is what happened. You throw them around enough, you'll break their necks. I mean, our skull, our brain, I mean, this is 15 pounds up here. It's a lot, I think. It's a substantial amount of weight. It's a big chunk of mass. That's why people get whiplashes with just a small tap on their car because, you know, the head moves so fast relative to the neck. A big one, and you, boom, you've broken your neck. And that's what happened to this guy. And I'm guessing, I'm predicting, that's what happened to Freddie Gray, is that he got killed by being in the back of a van that was and flying around, you know, being given a Baltimore rough ride by the Baltimore cops. And that this is something that they do. Get somebody they don't like, somebody, you know, walking while black, urinating while black, in the case of Mr. Johnson. Walking through a drug infested, running through a drug infested neighborhood in the case of Mr. Gray, while black, oh my God, stick him in the back of the car and give him a Baltimore rough ride. This is just so wrong. And I got to tell you about chocolate. We'll get to these things. We've got an hour and a half, an hour and 15 minutes. We'll get to all these things. I'll be picking up your calls right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The relationship between chocolate and having a clear mind in old age. This is amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Odell in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Odell, thanks for calling. Hello, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Look, I got two quickies. Here we go. Okay. Campaign. All the Democrats have to do is just show the filibuster that the Republicans filibuster. That speaks for itself. Now, I got another quickie.
Okay.
I know three football players. There was a company left out of here. These guys put up $25 million apiece and make what they were making. So you can do this across the board. But you got to stop taking taxpayers' money, putting it up so companies can take the money, build new plants overseas, and keep our money. Now, that's it, Tom, and I want to thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll hang up.
Oh, thank you, Adele. Apropos of your first point, you know, just talk about the filibusters, there was actually legislation when the Democrats controlled the House of Representatives and Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House in the first 2 years of the Obama administration. They passed successfully legislation that did away with the tax breaks that American companies get right now if they build factories overseas and replaced them with tax breaks that American companies would get if they brought their factories back home. That common sense legislation that would have created millions of American jobs and would have made it more difficult for big corporations to offshore their manufacturing, that was it had enough support in the Senate to pass, but it was filibustered by the Republicans. And that's that. If you're going to show any legislation, Odell, as an example of, you know, the perfidy of these guys, that's where I would start. Thanks a lot for the call. Michael in Imperial Beach, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, Anything Goes Thursday.
There you go.
You just mentioned the Lucky Sperm Club.
Right.
Our last conversation was about misogyny, the Bible, Adam and Eve, etc.
Right.
What are your thoughts about the Immaculate Conception, and how do you explain that the Immaculate Conception happened without a sperm fertilizing a female egg?
I think the Immaculate Conception is mythology.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I'm with Thomas Jefferson. You know, he took the New Testament, the first four books of the New Testament, the Gospels, and cut out, and you know, took a razor blade and cut out all the miracles and turned Jesus into a deeply profound philosopher, but a philosopher. And there's some of those miracles maybe, but
okay,
the virgin birth, no, it doesn't make any sense to me.
Right. So Jesus, as far as we know, Jesus Christ was the only human being to never have been born from a sperm meeting an egg.
Well, I don't believe that. I believe that he was, you know, I mean, Mary and Joseph might not have been married, and that might have been why she was going, hey, I don't know where it came from. Must have been God. But, you know, it's It just doesn't, you know, I don't, in fact, the reason why I think it's mythology is, first of all, you find it in Zoroastrianism, you find it in a whole bunch of religions that predated Christianity, many of whom we borrowed rituals from. We borrowed things like the Yule log and the Christmas tree and all. So even many of the quote pagan religions have stories of virgin births in them. So there's, you know, this is something that goes way back, and it probably goes, you know, way back as a consequence of the conflict between patriarchy and matriarchy as societies were working these things out. But, you know, that's just my opinion. I could be wrong, and maybe I'll burn in hell for the rest of my life for saying that, but I don't think so. Michael, thank you for the call. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by thankless.com/watch, where you can see the story of Sholene and Kier, the slave from South Sudan. Victoria, welcome.
Thanks very much.
I see you're at in the basement of the White House. What's going on?
I am. Yes, I just ducked out of the White House briefing with Josh Earnest. President Obama came out to the briefing room this morning, and really with a grim face, he offered an emotional apology to reporters, including myself, for the accidental killing of two hostages held by Al-Qaeda, one of them American, in a United States government counterterrorism operation in January, saying he takes full responsibility for their deaths as president and commander-in-chief. So I profoundly regret what happened. On behalf of the U.S. government, I offer our deepest apologies to the families. One was Warren Weinstein, who's a 73-year-old American USAID worker held by Al-Qaeda since 2011, and Giovanni Loporto, an Italian held since 2012, also a humanitarian worker. Two other Americans held by Al-Qaeda, Ahmed Farouk and Adam Gadan, were also killed in American operations in the same region, and neither of them had been specifically targeted, and they're present at the sites of the operations wasn't known at the time. Josh Earnest was asked this afternoon whether it was a drone strike, which everybody is assuming it was. Nobody will confirm that. And President Obama did not specifically sign off on these strikes. They were part of strikes that have already been pre-authorized, and so they are signed off on.
Okay. Can you imagine having a job where periodically you have to apologize to people that in the course of doing your job you killed somebody?
No, I can't imagine this.
It's got to be really, really tough.
And the president has spoken to the widow of Warren Weinstein.
Wow.
Who has issued a statement, and they apparently have been in quite close touch with the Weinstein family ongoing. They first knew about this, according to Earnest, the Weinstein family, in February, about the possibility that he might be dead.
Wow.
When the U.S. government started getting indications of it. But the president spoke to her in detail yesterday. She's saying they're devastated. They were hopeful that those in the U.S. and Pakistani governments with the power to take action and secure his release would have done everything possible to do so. She criticized the administration. Nevertheless, she says, but those who took Warren captive over 3 years ago bear ultimate responsibility, and she called them cowardly actions.
Remarkable.
In addition, senators today moved towards confirming Loretta Lynch as the nation's next attorney general. In a 66-34 vote, senators invoked cloture on President Obama's nominee. That sets up a final vote this afternoon. Now, it's not clear how many Republicans will support her in the end, but they got some interesting votes in the cloture vote. They got Kelly Ayotte. They got Thad Cochran, Richard Burr. They got John Cornyn.
Wow. So these guys are, so if they vote no on the main vote, but they voted yes on the let's end the debate, in other words, let's break the filibuster and move on to the vote, they will be able to go back to their folks and say, oh, yeah, I voted for Loretta Lynch when it's convenient, and or to another crowd, they could say, and I voted against Loretta Lynch.
They can. I mean, what they can say is, you know, that they're voting for the debate.
Yeah.
They're not blocking the debate.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, there's no filibuster on nominees. You're right.
Right. They're voting for the debate. Yeah.
Yeah. But still, they can say, yeah, I voted for cloture on her.
Right. They didn't vote for cloture. I mean, ultimately, it's 51 votes. They only need 5 Republicans.
Right.
And they believe they've got them.
I see. Okay.
And even if they lose one, they can always, you know, rumble Joe Biden over.
Mm-hmm.
So they should be okay.
Okay.
President Obama has a new target in his push for trade this afternoon. He will speak to the Organizing for Action PAC. That is his own political organization that arose out of his campaign structure. He wants to convince them that his push for trade promotion authority is the right one. He wants to tell them that they're misreading progressive politics if they want to oppose it.
Okay.
So we'll see how that goes.
Indeed.
It's going to be very interesting because many of them may naturally oppose it, but of course they want to support the president.
Which is a tough one.
A very tough one.
Yeah.
Meantime, a lot of VA news going on.
Mm-hmm.
Documents were passed to the House Committee on Veterans Affairs, and they could pass them on to the New York Times, published a story today, mm-hmm. saying that out of the 280,000 employees in the VA, only 8 have been punished for the wait time scandal, and only 3 have been fired.
Well, you could apply that to banksters, too.
You could.
And then contrast that, as apparently John Stewart did last night, with the cheating teachers in Atlanta.
You could. You could. But nevertheless, it is singular.
Yeah. I saw where, what was it, Deutsche Bank just pled guilty to some giant, you know, they're making some giant fine that they're paying. Yeah, Deutsche Bank, $2.5 billion for rate rigging. And part of this was that they had to fire 3 employees. Nobody went to jail. And this is $2.5 billion.
Wow.
And whereas down in Atlanta, you get some teachers who are trying to keep their schools open by rigging their tests because of this teach to the test thing. And they're charged under RICO. They're going to jail for decades. Excuse me.
No, it's fascinating.
Yeah, back to you. You're the
meantime,
reporter.
Representative Steve King of Iowa has introduced the Restrain the Judges on Marriage Act to stop federal courts from hearing same-sex marriage cases. This is a week, of course, before the Supreme Court plans to hear arguments in potentially one of the nation's most influential cases on gay marriage. This is, he says, for too long, federal courts have overstepped their constitutionally limited duty to interpret the Constitution, and his bill strips away Article 3 of the Constitution, giving federal courts the jurisdiction to hear or decide any question pertaining to the interpretation of or validity under the Constitution of any type of marriage.
Amazing.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. couple of things I want to share with you, and then we'll pick up your phone calls on this Anything Goes Thursday. The first is a study that a friend of mine in Australia, a professor at Swinburne University, we've known each other for years. We correspond a lot about brain function. He's a professor of neurology and brain function. In fact, we met at a brain conference. And he sent me this link to this article that was in Nature Neuroscience. It was published on October 26, 2014. So this was the fall of last year. And the title of it is Enhancing Dentate Gyrus Function with and my apologies to any of you who are actual scientists if I'm mispronouncing any of these words. Enhancing Dentate Gyrus Function with Dietary Flavanols Improves Cognition in Older Adults. What, you may ask, is the dentate gyrus, or gyrus, however you say it, and what's a flavanol? Well, flavanols are things that are in food, and they're really, you know, one of the richest sources of flavanols and flavonoids out there, and they tend to be antioxidants also, is chocolate. And so this is from the abstract. The dentate gyrus, the DG, is a region in the hippocampal formation. This is the hippocampus. That's where we do short-term memory, whose function declines in association with human aging and is therefore considered to be a possible source of age-related memory decline. So in a controlled randomized trial, we studied healthy 50 to 69-year-old subjects who consumed either a high or low cocoa-containing diet for 3 months. A high flavanol intervention was found to enhance DG function as measured by functional MRI, magnetic resonance imaging. This is, you know, taking pictures of the brain, and by cognitive testing. In other words, by, you know, cognitive meaning how you think, testing how well you think. Our findings establish that DG dysfunction is a driver of age-related cognitive decline and suggest non-pharmacological means for its amelioration. In other words, eating chocolate on a regular basis, on a virtually daily basis, and we're not talking about talking about the kind of cheap stuff chocolate you can buy in a candy store, but I'm guessing, since they said cocoa rather than chocolate, that they're talking about stuff that's like really, really high in cocoa, really high in the essential chocolate, you know, like the Lindt, L-I-N-D-T, a German or Swiss company, I think. And they make this 80% cocoa, 85% cocoa, 70%, 85%, 90%, and 99%, which I've had all of them. The 99% is bitter. The 90% is pretty strong. The 85% is pretty strong. 70%, then you got a little too much sugar. But anyhow, it's just, so I just ordered a case of chocolate for the studio here. Shane goes, oh, great. I don't think he's happy. Okay. George W. Bush is going to make $250,000 on Saturday. It's amazing. He's going to make $250,000. How? Well, he and John Boehner and a bunch of other Republicans are going to Las Vegas for the Sheldon Adelson primary. See, this is not the Nevada primary. This is not the Utah primary. It's not the Texas primary. It's not a primary in any state. It's not a primary where voters get to decide. This is the primary where one obscenely rich guy decides who's going to be a nominee for president of the United States, Sheldon Adelson, with money that he made in China, in Macau, with his casinos in Macau, and also with his casinos in the United States. And it looks like he's leaning toward Marco Rubio, but Mike Pence, the former talk show host who's now the governor of Indiana, Ted Cruz, the former wacko bird, was that what he called himself? Crazy bird, something like that, who's now the senator from Texas. And Rick Perry, the former governor of Texas, who's now unemployed and desperately seeking meaning, are all going to go make a sales pitch to Sheldon Adelson about how much they hate liberals, hate Democrats, and love Republicans and Israel. So, but what does it say about our country? And George W. Bush is going to be paid $250,000 to give a speech. What does it say about our country when this is what's going on? that the richest 1/100th of 1% of Americans, this is roughly 30,000 individuals, the richest 1/100th of 1% of Americans gave 42% of political donations in 2012. We don't have the numbers for 2014. I'm sure it's much higher than 42%, and we won't know until, you know, a few years down the road what happens next year in 2016. But I think it's going to be more like 70, 80, 90%. You're seeing candidates being backed by super PACs that are organized by and funded by one individual. The Shelley Adelson super PAC, the Koch brothers super PAC, the, you know, on and on they go. This is no way to run a democracy. Even if you've got an occasional billionaire like Tom Steyer who will kick in $50 million to try and save the planet, it's no way to run a democracy. So, and my Deutsche Bank rant. Deutsche Bank, this from the New York Times, Jack Ewing. Deutsche Bank will pay $2.5 billion penalty to the United States and British authorities to settle accusations that it helped manipulate the benchmarks used to set interest rates on trillions of dollars in mortgages, student loans, credit cards, and other debt. In other words, your mortgage might have cost you more. Your student loans might have cost you more. Your credit card interest might have cost you more because Deutsche Bank was rigging interest rates. You may have been harmed. Because Deutsche Bank was rigging interest rates, Deutsche Bank is going to pay a $2.5 billion fine. I started going through the article going, okay, you know, in fact, the article, this Benjamin Lowski, the New York State Superintendent of Financial Services, said in a statement on Thursday, Deutsche Bank employees engaged in a widespread effort to manipulate benchmark interest rates for financial gain. Markets don't just manipulate themselves. It takes deliberate wrongdoing by individuals. So I'm sitting here going, okay, you got a bunch of black teachers in Atlanta who conspired to rig tests to essentially keep their schools open in the face of No Child Left Behind mandatory testing in neighborhoods where the kids are just, you know, the best predictor of school performance is the wealth of their parents, right? I mean, this is just regardless of anything else you can put into their race, class, geography, gender, whatever, the best predictor of somebody's success in school is how much money their parents make and have. The wealthier the kid, you know, the family that the child comes from is, the more likely they are to succeed. The less wealthy, the less likely they are to succeed. These teachers were in schools with kids who were coming out of the worst kind of poverty we have in the United States. So they rigged a test so that the school didn't get closed and the kids didn't get kicked out, which I may well have done too. And they're looking at 10, 20 years in prison. I mean, really serious jail time they got sentenced to. Is it because they're African American? Is it because they're teachers? Is it because there's a jihad in Georgia against both? I mean, I can't conclusively say, but I can tell you that these white bankers at Deutsche Bank, who the, you know, the guy said, you know, $2.5 billion fine. This is huge. Seven of their managers were at, they asked the bank to fire them. The authorities, they ordered them. The authorities also ordered the bank to fire seven managers suspected of involvement in the wrongdoing, but all of whom, all but one of whom are in London. They are among more than 24 employees believed to have taken part in this, most of whom have already left the bank. $2.5 billion screwed millions of people. What do they get? Well, a couple of people, you know, low-level flunkies lost their job. Teachers in Atlanta, nobody was hurt because of what the teachers in Atlanta did. In fact, the school stayed open. They go to prison.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
A, I wonder what would have happened if those teachers had been white. I genuinely don't think they would have gone to prison. And B, this is nuts. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bob in Farmington, Missouri, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind? What's
up? Hey, Tom. I don't think that that guy sustained his injuries in that van. I've been a martial artist all my life, and I think it was a forearm that smashed that guy's trachea.
could it not have been the edge of a vertical partition or a, you know, the stool for a seat or something like that? I mean, there are stanchions.
It's possible.
And, yeah.
It's possible, but that man, there's heavy odds against that.
Yeah. So that, you that, think he was beaten up?
I think that a guy put him in a chokehold. The forearm goes around the front. That hand grabs the other forearm. The other hand goes behind the head. And if you're struggling and you lose your footing and they back up two steps, your own weight snaps your neck.
It's equivalent to being hung.
Yes.
Or hanged, I guess, would be the correct English.
Yes. It's virtually the same thing.
Right. May well be. It may well be, Bob. I don't know. I just find it interesting that 10 years ago, the exact same thing happened, and that guy died of a broken neck. It took him a week to die, but he died of a broken neck, and he was fine when they put him in the van, and his neck was broken when the van stopped, and he was alone in the back, and he got the Baltimore rough ride. He got thrown around a lot. So,
well, I'm sure this
I mean,
guy did.
Consider the damage that happens to somebody in a car accident. And nowadays, you know, in car accidents, a lot of people have their seatbelts on. Plus, the inside of the car is padded. You know, the inside of the back of a van is not padded. It's all steel. And there's stainless
steel. He was handcuffed.
Presumably, yeah. Yeah.
Consider this, though.
Mm-hmm.
Witnesses beforehand said that the cops bent him like a pretzel.
Oh, my. Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, they're doing an investigation. They're taking it very seriously. I think that's a good thing. Everybody is all agog about, you know, holy cow, look at all these black people who are being killed by cops. You know, when did this start? How did this happen? What's going on in America? You know, I'm sorry, this has been going on forever. Hey, Bob, thank you for the call. This has been going on forever. It's just that now, This is what's called a disruptive technology, right? Like Uber is upsetting the taxi drivers here in town. It's a disruptive technology. Cell phone cameras are a disruptive technology. And the main thing that they're disrupting is this good old boy system that the police have, that cops have all over the country, of kicking the crap out of black people and then lying about it. Oh, no, I didn't do that. Oh, well, yeah, I shot him, but I had to because he was shooting at me. Oh, yeah, we arrested that guy because he had cocaine in his pocket. You know, all these scams that bad cops have run. And hopefully now, as this disruptive technology, these video cameras start, you know, the other one that came out yesterday was this woman who was videotaping the police. The cop comes over, grabs her phone, and smashes it. But a third person was videotaping the cops. And so now the cops are in trouble over that. It's like African-Americans in this country, black people in this country have known forever that police behave badly. The rest of us are just now finding out, that is, you know, white people in America are just now finding out, or many white people in America are just now finding out, by virtue of these cell phone cameras. And it's about time. Hopefully it'll lead to some genuine change. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Anita in San Antonio, Texas, watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind, Anita?
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I think that guy was probably hurt on the ground, and then his injuries were exacerbated in that van.
Yeah, may well
be. Yeah, but now what I wanted to ask was, the word freedom seems to have become the battle cry of conservatives.
Yeah. Well, it has been since the 30s.
Well, I don't understand what their definition is. I agree with you. I don't think people can be free if their basic needs aren't met.
Right.
But what do you think a conservative definition of freedom is?
Well, this is an amazing intellectual victory by the very wealthy. Their goal, and in a way, I mean, Lewis Powell doesn't come right out and say it, but if you read the Powell memo from 1971. He basically laid out their goal with regard to this. I reprint a lot of it in my book, The Crash of 2016. Their goal was to get average Republicans, people who vote Republican, to start thinking as if they were rich and voting as if they were rich. And so freedom, by their definition, is the freedom to be free of government interference. The government doesn't provide anything for you. It doesn't ask anything of you. So it doesn't ask taxes from you. And on the other hand, it doesn't provide you with health insurance or public education or any of those kind of things. And if you are a billionaire or even a millionaire, a multimillionaire anyway, then yeah, that's, you could call that a definition of freedom. But if you're anybody else, you know, so that applies maybe to the top 0.1%, but, or the top 0.01%. But for everybody else, no, not so much. And I find it astonishing that they, that the shills have so succeeded. The shills for the billionaires. I keep talking about these three classes of three groups of people in the Republican Party, the rich, the shills for the rich, and the suckers, and how successful they have become in indoctrinating the suckers to the point that the suckers will regurgitate these lines. You know, I want freedom. And you say, well, what does that mean? Well, I don't know. I just don't want the government telling me what to do. Well, why, you know, why is that freedom or not freedom? And if you don't have this government, some other government's going to come in. You know, it's like, it's anyway, Anita,
I think that in the 80s, also, they tried to make everyone think that they could be rich.
Yes.
They, you know,
you two can win the lottery
like that. Yeah,
or you two exactly. could invent the next Apple computer. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's part of that sales pitch, Anita, is you know, this whole lottery economy thing. But, yeah, that's a good question. I want to get Sheriff Mack back. I want to have this as, in fact, I'd love to have him in the studio for a couple of hours and really, really dig deep into this stuff on, and get inside his head and inside mine. Pardon?
Yes, please ask him what he means.
Yeah.
Because
I'll do that.
That's the question I ask. When I hear it, you know, I always say, well, what do you mean by that? And generally, they don't know.
Yeah, I suspect he has a very clear, you know, kind of Clive and Bundy. That's freedom, right? You can just take your cattle, put them wherever you want, and the government can't say anything or do anything. But I don't know. I mean, I don't want to speak on behalf of anybody when they're not here to defend themselves. So, Anita, thank you for the call. We'll see what happens. Mark in Orlando. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show. I had two questions about the TPP. Mm-hmm. First of all, would it nullify Obama's veto of the XL Keystone, because now TransCanada could sue us because they lost profits because we didn't allow their pipeline to go through?
That's a possibility.
Also, where are the 49 senators? Here with Iran, they don't allow any kind of agreements, but when it comes to trade, it's like it's open season.
Oh, yeah. It was 47. But, yeah, where are the 47 traders? Why don't they write a letter to the to whoever's negotiating this thing? You know, it's I'm with you. I mean, the Republicans are supporting TPP. The Wall Street is supporting TPP. Big transnational corporations are supporting TPP, and all the unions are opposed to it. That tells me everything I need to know. Mark, thank you for the call. John, in Portland, Oregon, listening to X-Ray FM, where they're having their fundraising drive right now. So, hey, if you're listening to X-Ray FM in Portland, please kick in something. Help them out. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Thank you, Tom, and all the folk you work with. You're wonderful people. And, Tom, I love your rants. We need some good rants. And one of mine is, I'm sick of the Republicans using Clinton as an example of moral turpitude.
Right.
And my comeback is, hey, folks, adultery in the United States is not against the law. If it was, 30-40% of us would be in prison probably. Yeah. And they wrecked Clinton's presidency with that, and it made it easier for that scum Bush Cheney to get in, and look what they've done to our country. And we've got to start getting more aggressive on answering these questions. And the sheriff kept interrupting you all the time. That's one of their tactics. And
I know he watches a lot of Fox News, so he thinks that's the way to do it.
And I've got some libertarian points. I think I'm a part libertarian. I've got this before. Oh, I don't like abortion. Well, great, then don't have one.
Right.
I'm against gay marriage. Well, great, don't marry a gay person.
Right.
It's real simple. It's called freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, but see, that's not libertarian. Libertarians have appropriated that. That's just historically, you know, that's not even Americanism. That's just rational behavior.
Right. They're doing, they have these sophists, I think I'm pronouncing
yes,
it right,
the sophists
all the time, where they cherry pick little issues to sidetrack the big issues that we're trying to talk about.
Yeah, I'm with Jefferson, where he said, I don't care if a man has one god or 10 gods, it neither picks my pocket nor harms my something or other. I don't remember the word, but in any case, he was like, so what? It's not my problem. How somebody prays, or it's whatever it may be. John, thank you for the call. I'm with you. It's 28 minutes past the hour. We're doing Anything Goes Thursday here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with your calls and a little bit more out of the news right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program. Call 202-536-2370.
I'll be back with you right after this break. Matriclinously ugly, the good. No somos delito. In protest of a new law that would ban protests in front of government buildings, this activist coalition in Spain did something unique. Over the weekend, they staged the world's first hologram protest in Madrid, the Spanish capital. According to coalition leaders, this is how they will have to protest if the proposed gag law goes into effect as planned on July 1st. You know, a democracy like life finds a way. Tagged. No somos delito. You're it. The bad. Governor Scott Walker, the Wisconsin governor, has found a way to celebrate Earth Day that even his buddies, the Koch brothers, probably find acceptable. Firing a bunch of his state's environmental workers. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, 57 employees of the State Department of Natural Resources began receiving formal notices this week that they might face layoff as part of Governor Scott Walker's budget for the next two fiscal years. In other words, happy Earth Day. Now go find a new job. Not even Mother Nature could be that cruel. And the very, very ugly Senator Lindsey Graham. When asked by a reporter Wednesday how long he thought the war on terror would last, the South Carolina senator responded as follows. The people in Guantanamo Bay are probably going to die in jail, and that's okay with me. 50 of the 122 prisoners still in Guantanamo Bay have already been cleared for release, and Senator Graham, and certified by our government, is not guilty of anything. And Senator Graham is apparently okay with them never seeing the light of day again. That's very, very ugly. Meanwhile, I was going to mention this. Kamal Benyanez, who called into our program last week, I believe, maybe it was early this week, from Tunisia. In fact, it was the day that Sherrod Brown was on, so I think it might have been Monday. In any case, called into the program and told us the story. He's diabetic and blind. He and his wife and their two kids live in Tunisia, and they're trying to raise enough money to get back to the United States. And they've got a GoFundMe page. I don't normally pitch these things, but I've been corresponding with this guy for over a year, and he's given me some amazing insights into what's going on in the Middle East. And I'm very grateful for that, and I want to kind of pay it back. They've got this GoFundMe page. It's GoFundMe.com/Benyanez Family, BENYOUNES Family. And Danielle, we're sending out a tweet and we're putting it on Facebook right now. Meanwhile, in Kansas, the poorest 20% of Kansas residents pay on average 11.1%. of their income in state taxes, mostly sales tax fees, licensing fees, this, that, and the other thing. But, you know, they pay 11% of their income in taxes. The top 1% of people in Kansas pay 3.6% of their income in taxes to the state. This is Sam Brownback radically slashed the taxes on rich people in Kansas. And so, and threw his state into a budget crisis. There's just, you know, hell to pay. I mean, Kansas is in a fiscal crisis right now because their governor actually, he was apparently a sucker too. I always thought that Sam Brownback was a paid shill. I thought he didn't believe that stuff, but he apparently believed the Reaganomics lie, the trickle down lie, the supply side lie. He believed it. And so he cut taxes on rich people in Kansas, which includes the Koch brothers who live in Kansas. and thought, okay, get ready for the prosperity. And the prosperity never came. So what's he going to do now? Raise taxes on rich people? Not a chance. After all, Koch brothers live there. No, he's going to raise taxes on poor people. That's right. Increase the sales tax. Isn't that sweet? I mean, doesn't it just, like, warm your heart? Anyhow, Cliff in Claremore, Oklahoma. Hey, Cliff, welcome to the program. What's up?
Well, I sure got an earful, that's for sure. But you mentioned something earlier about Jesus. Well,
somebody had called, and just, if I may, Cliff, just for people who weren't listening then, because every 15 minutes or so, about a third of our audience rolls over. What I had said was, I'm very skeptical about the virgin birth, and I can,
right.
I think I can be a Christian and be very respectful of Jesus and all that kind of stuff, and certainly go along with the things he said, and still be skeptical of the virgin birth. That's what I said. And I said, one of the reasons that I'm skeptical of it is that virgin births like that occur in lots and lots of mythology that predated Christianity. Back to you, Cliff.
Okay. Yeah, okay. Anyways, that's pretty much from the Egyptian playbook of Horus being raised from the dead. So, you know, there's something there.
That's the resurrection.
You know, I mean, there again, that's from Egyptian mythology there.
Right.
Okay, if you want to look at it from that basis, on that basis, that's exactly what it is.
Yep.
You know, and so there again, you mentioned something about mythology. Well, yeah, there you go. Here's Egyptian mythology in the works right there. And this is what people have been believing for eons now.
Right, right. And it's only dangerous when they act on those beliefs in ways that harm other people. You know, if somebody wants to believe
Absolutely.
In the virgin birth, you know, the rest of their life, no problem, you know, from my point of view. On the other hand, if they want to look at that same Bible and believe that they should put people to death because they wear clothing made of two fabrics, or they eat shellfish, or their children, they are children who talked back to their parents, they're supposed to be put to death, or whatever. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on. Or they're gay, right? They should be put to death. If you're going to do that, sorry, you know, at that point, your religion has become a problem for all of us. But you know,
absolutely.
Okay.
Well, the thing is, too, is, well, you look at it on the basis of how they've been using religion as a bludgeon, and I tend to have more tolerance for people who are Christ-like, not Christian, and the reason for that is because Christ would be upset with the way his religion or the religion named after him was has been perverted. Yeah, the same way Allah has probably, it would be appalled at the way his or Muhammad. Be appalled at the way his religion has been.
I think you're right, Cliff. I think if Jesus showed up tomorrow and you know and started going knocking on church doors, probably 95% of them would throw him out. It's a fascinating thing. Cliff, thank you for the call. Shirley in Wheeling, West Virginia. Hey, Shirley, what's on your mind?
Well, Tom, I wanted to go back to talking about banking.
Mm-hmm.
I took your advice, and I did go and I got my money out of the local bank, and I'm working with credit union now, mm-hmm. and my daughter, too. But I just wanted to tell a little story to the people out there listening. Do not go for these government loans. They're really just gangsters. I have had a 30-year mortgage with the Farmers Home Administration, and I got this house in 1986 for $39,000. And now, 30 years later, I call to find out the payoff, and it's $40,000. So I'm totally beside myself. I wrote a letter to President Obama asking him if he would let me be eliminated from the bill instead of the turkey last Thanksgiving. And I got a letter back from him saying, we'd love to help you, but contact this fella, and here it was the guy at FHA, which is like telling a kidnapper to talk to their keeper, you know. And I just wanted to warn people. So these kids, you got to fight against these college loans, because if you get them, they're going to have you for years. And my girlfriend, who's 70, I'm 68, she's 70. Do you know they deduct out of her Social Security check, Tom, her Berkeley loan that she still owes after all the? It's been like 45 years. She's still paying for her
Berkeley education because it's all the interest on it.
Yeah.
She never gets out of it. And now they take it out of her social check. And both of us only live on $1,000 a month. So it's just, so don't go for these reverse mortgages. It's just a con game. Don't take a 30-year mortgage with the government because they'll just screw you in the end. Here, I still owe as much as I did 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, something has happened, Shirley. You may want to have somebody audit that loan because you should not owe what you owed 30 years ago.
Well, I didn't know who to call when I talked to bankers and things. They all say nobody wants to fight it because they've actually sold my loan to some company out in St. Louis. You only get people, you know, like an machine. And I did go to an attorney. He said, I don't know what to make of it. They just don't know what to make of it. And I don't know a professional to call. But I think somebody wants to invest.
The odds are that he didn't know what to make of it because you couldn't afford to pay him to go to dive deep enough to figure out what to make of it. And that's one of the real crises we have. Do you have any friends or neighbors who are attorneys or CPAs?
No, we're all poor. It's West Virginia, and I only get $1,000 a month Social Security.
Right.
And even as we speak, I pay my payment. I'm perfectly on time, and yet I still owe the same $40,000 that I owed when I bought the house in 1986. I can't get over it.
It's amazing.
And I did.
Surely there's something.
FHA, and he said, "I'm sorry, ma'am. There's nothing I can do about it."
Yeah.
He said, "Believe me, people call all the time and call me every name in the book."
Shirley, call your congressman. Call your member of the House of Representatives. They and say, I'd like to speak to somebody in constituent services. I don't know who represents you. It's almost certainly a Republican. That's fine. Don't talk politics with them. But call your congressman and say, I want to talk to somebody in constituent services. I have a problem. I've been paying on this loan for 30 years, and the amount that I owe is the same as it was 30 years ago. That's not right. Because there's something, I'm telling you, Shirley, there's something fundamentally wrong. And your congressman or one of your two senators, I was going to say you could call either of your two senators, too. In fact, I met Joe Manchin a couple of nights ago here in D.C. It's just, said hi. He said, hey, happy on your show. So, Shirley, call Joe Manchin's office and tell him I told you to call. That I met him a couple of nights ago. Try it out. See what happens. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The other thing is, if you have a mortgage, well, this is what I did when we were young. If you can pay an extra $100 a month or whatever, anything you've got left over into it, that's the best way to save. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. John in Girard, Pennsylvania. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish. What's up?
Oh, I'm just asking about the Constitution.
Okay.
The Constitution made by wealthy white men, right?
Well, yes and no. Back in the 1930s, there was a socialist professor of history here in the United States. His wife's name was Mary. His name will come to me when I'm not trying to think of it. And he was a fairly famous guy, and he wrote a book called The History of the History of the United States. And in that book, he basically asserted that the Constitution was written by rich white guys to protect property interests, to protect the interests of rich white guys. In the 1950s, a fellow by the name of Forrest MacDonald looked at this story of history that we had been accepting since the 1930s and said, is it true? And he went back, and I write about this at some length in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? Just FYI, you can find all the footnotes and everything, all the references there, and it's free in any library. It's been out for years. And Forrest MacDonald looked at the ratifying convention state by state, and what he discovered was that the vast majority of the people who voted for the Constitution were not rich. In fact, the vast majority of them were poor farmers and poor working people. The state conventions were not dominated by rich people, and occasionally even, you know, rich people would vote for the Constitution, but they tended to vote against it. The rich people really kind of liked the Articles of Incorporation or the Articles of Confederation, rather than the Constitution. And that, which answers the question that a lot of people have been asking for a lot of years about, you know, when they wrote the Constitution, they locked themselves in to Constitution Hall in Philadelphia for the 2 months or so that it took to do it in the summer of 1787, I think it was, or maybe it was 1786. No, 1787. And James Madison kept the notes on the Constitution, but he did not publish them until after his death. And by that point in time, everybody else was dead, too. In fact, he was still working on writing the commentary on the notes when he died. And so why did they keep it secret what they were doing for the lifetime of every one of the men who was in that room? It turns out, when you look at Forrest MacDonald's understanding of this, rather than Charles and Mary Beard, the name just came to me. Charles Beard was a historian who said, oh, it was rich white guys for rich white guys. Turns out that they locked themselves in that room and they kept the proceedings in secret because they were violating their own class. They were not creating a constitution for rich white guys. They were creating a constitution for at least all the white
people. Oh, it's all white people, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they wrote slavery into the Constitution. We have to acknowledge that. You know, the racism was very much there. But it was not, the Constitution was not designed to be and is not the class structure document that Charles Beard, and who is a Marxist, fundamentally skeptical of the American system of government in some ways, have portrayed it as. So, there's good and bad to it, John. You know?
Yeah, I'm just glad it's progressive.
Yeah.
So it's...
Oh, it was an insanely progressive document. I mean, the Constitution came out of the Enlightenment. This was the first attempt in 2,000 years to create a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. First time in 2,000 years. These guys were really... Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that they did it. John, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. 10 minutes before you. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Bill in Dayton, Ohio. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, buddy.
Hey.
I'm not talking to you. I was hanging on for your patience. I was going to give you three topics, but since it's short and sweet, I'll stick to the last one.
Thank you.
And it's what just happened a week ago about our friend, another young black man.
Mm-hmm.
If you watch the video, and I'm very overly observant.
Are you talking about Freddie Gray in Baltimore?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Those police officers were on bicycles, bicycling the neighborhood. The guy was in a jogging outfit, jogging. Of course, it's illegal to jog. I understand.
No, it's not. It's not, actually.
I know.
Yeah.
I heard it earlier on Amy and you guys. Yeah. But on the ground, next to where their bikes are, there's a construction folding ladder that folds up four times flat. It should be about 2 foot tall. Now, my sis had a DWI by a driver, sent her through the front windshield of the car, and broke 3 vertebrae in her neck.
Right.
And her friend. They both landed in his car. They were dead on the scene.
Ooh.
All right? That young man had a broken leg, completely severed below the knee. You can see it being dragged opposite of his body. And for someone to crush the back of your neck, that doctor did not need to leave him alive for a whole week outside insurance.
Yeah.
His neck was broke. He was dead then. And when they crushed his vertebrae and his vocal cords, the vocal cords is our favorite cop thing to do. Slamming you down against a bicycle bar or a nightstick or a foot. I'd say it was before he went in the back door. Oh, and by the way, they dragged him back out the back door, handcuffed him, and did like the girl that was a sister to the 12-year-old boy in Cleveland. Picked him up by his clothes and threw him in.
Yeah.
And that's what everybody saw.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to be treated like that, and I don't think anybody in America should ever be treated like that. This is not Nazi.
Yeah, I'm with you. Well said, Bill. So you think that he was not injured by getting a Baltimore rough ride from the police, having the van thrown around
in
the back?
I think he was already dead.
You think he was a dead man walking?
He was screaming.
Yeah.
By the time they put the handcuffs on him, nothing.
Yeah. Okay. You may well be right, Bill. We'll have to find out. Thank you for the call. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Norma, what's up?
I'll be quick. Last night on The Big Picture, you were talking about new legislation regarding bosses and birth control. Do you know the name of the bill and who presented it?
No, I don't. I'm sorry. Not off the top of my head.
Oh, okay. So you have no idea when that bill will be coming up and what's how?
I'm sorry, Norma. I don't have the details in front of me right now.
It's
What were you talking about? Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm very sorry. It's specific pieces of legislation. Rob in Mountain Iron, Minnesota. Hey, Rob, what's up? Thanks for listening to Sirius.
Hi, Tom. It's where, with the TPP, it's where anybody that's been around, you know, as long as we have, they've said it, but going back to CAFTA, 1987-88, Canadian Free Trade Agreement.
Yep.
With all of the agreements that have been made, basically, it has done nothing for the American middle class. And now with a record like that, President Obama, even if he wanted to, and he could make a good deal out of this, with a proven record of all of these other agreements, why would anybody go along with him on this? Except for the Republicans, so that they can blame him again for everything.
I think you're right. And if you look at the history of the United States and our trade deficits, and for, you know, every $1 billion of trade deficit, you're looking at roughly 13,000 lost jobs. We had a trade surplus in the United States from the founding of the Republic until the Reagan administration. And then we started running trade deficits. And we've been running massive trade deficits for the last 40 years, 35, 40 years. I'll have to dig into this to get the exact numbers. But and every single time we sign one of these trade agreements, our trade deficits go up even farther, and which means more jobs leave this country. And it's just it's wrong. You're right.
The only thing that stayed consistent over the years is where the Republicans haven't done anything. They have blocked everything that tried to get done. But the one thing that stayed consistent, they always blamed President Obama.
Right. Yeah, I'm with you. Rob, thank you for the call. Woody in Litchfield Park, Arizona. Hey, Woody, what's up?
Oh, a couple of things. One, I'm real happy to hear you talking about Alexander Hamilton. I hold him to be more of what we should understand in this country than Thomas Jefferson. I know Thomas had it stuff.
Well, the old cliche, Hamilton, which is I think very true, is that everybody in America quotes Jefferson, but we really live in Hamilton's America.
And that's where I wanted to go with the woman who called about her farmer's home loan and how terrible it was.
Right.
I'm a former supervisor, and I've got lots of stories I could tell you. But in this one, I think it's real clear that during the late 70s and 80s, remember, interest rates were awfully high?
Yeah.
And people were having a hard time getting loans. Well, our program is 100% loan, no money down. And if you're low income, we'll drop that interest rate, whatever the current rate was. And it got up to 13% at one point.
Right.
We drop it down to 1% according to your income. But then you signed a shared appreciation agreement. And that was a result of what we saw in the late 70s coming through the 80s, was that people were getting 1% loans and prices, their housing was advancing. So they'd get a 1% loan, and the people that got the subsidy were getting equity, where people that were paying the full rate had very little equity.
I see.
And this was to equalize that. So I can only assume that her house is worth that much more. And since she received the subsidy in interest, that's how it came through.
So what should she do right now,
more.
Woody? What should she do? We're just about out of time.
Well, she received the subsidy in the past based on the value of her home, and it's increased. If she refinances, take it from there. But it was an agreement set a long time ago, and if she didn't understand it, I don't know where we go from here.
Okay. Thank you, Woody. Thank you. You know more about it than me, so I'll just leave it at that. Thanks so much for being with us this week. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires all of us. You too. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.